Roundabout with Tony Barnfield on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Dr. Michael Wood, you are, sir, a life fellow of Gonville and Keys. You must be of a certain age.
Yes, indeed. I'm glad to say that as a life fellow, I have actually been a member of the college for just on 60 years.
Right, which makes you, what, in your 80s?
Oh, I see. You want to see how old I am. Well, in fact, I have just celebrated my 90th birthday.
Right. I know that history is quite an interest of yours. Is that what you've taught?
No, I'm an engineer, and I started off my life Rolls-Royce in the aero division and gradually worked my way up, and during that period, I realised there were certain advantages in going to Cambridge, and so I managed to arrange matters so that I was accepted by St Catherine's College.
And life was good at St Cat's?
St Catherine's was excellent, yes. I thoroughly enjoyed my time, particularly because during that period I became engaged to my wife, and we were married actually by my tutor, my St Catherine's tutor, which was very pleasant.
So, when did your involvement with Gonville and Keys begin?
Well, after I had finished research at St Catherine's, I went back into industry and worked at Lincoln for a number of years. I then had the opportunity to come back to Cambridge, and in those days, one would normally expect to wait for about 5 years to obtain a fellowship or anything like that. But when I came back to teach, I was very fortunate in that Gonville and Keys had a vacancy. One of their senior fellows was just retiring, and they asked me if I would like to join the college.
So that was 1959, I believe.
That was 1959, yes.
What did you think at the time of Keys, as people tend to call it these days? Did you see that you were going to be here for a lifetime, practically?
No, it was very interesting because at the time I thought I was being interviewed as a control and that somebody else was already set up for this fellowship. And I regret to say perhaps I didn't take my interview too seriously. The net result was that they offered me the fellowship.
So obviously you came over very relaxed and very confident.
I think that must have been the case.
Now, I was surprised to learn that Gonville and Keys, which is quite an interesting early history, actually began life in Norfolk.
The college hardly started in Norfolk, but our founder was a rector of a parish in Norfolk on the south side of the Wash, and he, we believe, acted as land agent for a number of large landowners and accumulated quite a lot of wealth, with which he endowed actually three separate foundations: the Dominican Friars at Thetford, and then a chantry at Rushford, and then later on Gonville Hall in Cambridge.
Ah, so he did found that here. And it ran quite well on quite a small basis, I believe.
Yes, that's correct. It went along quite steadily until about 1529, when a very bright young man called John Keys came into college.
So those key dates were 1348, when Gonville set up the college, yes, and then the 1550s for its modern life, almost.
Yes, the position was that John Keys was very, very bright. He became a scholar, and he became top of the university in examinations in those days, and then he became a fellow, and after he'd been a fellow for a number of years, he went off to Padua to study medicine. And then it was after that that he came back and practised in the city of London.
And the Keys is spelt oddly, isn't it? C-A-I-U-S. Is that Latin?
It is. It's a Latinised form. If you remember, we're talking about the Shakespearean period, Elizabethan period, when the spelling of people's names was not actually standardised. Shakespeare spelt his name several different ways, and John Keys spelt his name about 9 different ways. His usual spelling was K-E-Y-S, but when it came to Latin documents, it was convenient to use the Latinised version, C-A-I-U-S, but we still keep the pronunciation of Keys.
And of course, when the college is on something like University Challenge, it's always called just Keys. How did that happen, given that it is Gonville and Keys?
I think it's just a question of time, that people prefer a short name rather than a lengthy one.
And it's the fourth oldest, I believe, Peterhouse, followed by Clare, followed by Pembroke.
And then Gonville Hall in 1348. That's correct, yes.
Right. And when did you start moving into the modern age and allowing the opposite sex to come in?
That occurred in our case in 1978. We changed our statutes, and then in 1979 we've admitted the first girls.
And it was that sort of period when quite a few colleges were beginning to
do that. Yes, the first breakthrough, as people would say, was in 1972 when three colleges went mixed. But I think this college probably played, shall we say, a waiting game to see how things were going. But the position changed, and it was very obvious that we were losing out in every sense of the word by not being mixed. And so we changed our statutes in 1978.
And you'd been here by about 20 years at that time. Did it see a significant difference?
I think it would be true to say that it hardly made any difference at all. One of our former masters put it this way: we've always had women in Keys.
Now, you are a man of wit, and you do blue badge guiding, I believe, and have done for a number of years.
Yes, I've been a blue badge guide for 25 years now, which I've enjoyed enormously. And the great thing, of course, is you meet such interesting people from over the whole world.
And do you have a sort of set walk or whatever, or did you have? Because I know now you tend to keep within the college.
Yes, the local tourist board encourages us to follow a particular route which would involve certain colleges, because that is apparently what the tourists want. But on any particular day, you must be flexible, because you get to a college where you've planned everything beautifully and find there's a wedding on and the college is completely closed.
So you must have a head full of anecdotes to tell just on the spot.
Yes, I think that's true.
What's your favourite one?
The favourite story that I like to tell is actually a Keys story. It's called The Car on the Senate House Roof. And a lot of people have heard about this story. What happened? About a dozen of our engineering undergraduates decided that the roof of the Senate House was very plain and uninteresting and even boring and needed some decoration. And so they decided that they would put a motor car on the roof of the Senate House. And they did.
Now, I am told by a possibly reliable source that they did it in bits. Is that how it got up there?
No, quite the reverse. It was a complete car and it was hoisted in one piece. It had to be made as light as possible, which they did by taking out the engine and the seats and taking off the back doors. So they got the weight right down, but it was still hoisted up as a single vehicle.
How was it that nobody spotted it happening?
Because they very wisely chose the middle of the night following the last day of the bumps. So there were bump suppers going on, and the hope was there'd be so many drunken undergraduates roaming the streets after the bump suppers that the police would be fully occupied.
Which clearly they were.
It turned out that way.
Yes. And how did it get down?
Oh, that in itself is an interesting story, because the city fathers took one look at it and said that won't take us very long to get down, because it's obviously made of cardboard. But it wasn't. And they found that when they tried to get it down. They instructed the civil defence and the fire brigade and the police to get it down, and unfortunately they did not have the engineering skills which our undergraduates did, and I'm afraid they really made rather a mess of it. And after 2 days they found they couldn't get it down, so in the end they got an oxyacetylene torch and chopped it up into small pieces and dropped the pieces over one by one, and that was how they got it down.
So that's where I got the idea of the pieces of the vehicle.
I think
vehicle.
So, yes, yes,
yes. So we are a city of tourists and see a lot from the other end of the world, don't we, from China and so these days. They are valuable to the city, but they do change its nature somewhat, don't they? What's your view on that?
I like to feel hospitable towards tourists because, as an inhabitant of Cambridge, I like to tell other people about what we've achieved and what goes on here. The difficulties, I'm afraid, are with what we call uncontrolled tourists, large groups spilling over the pavements and getting in everybody's way. You mentioned that as a Blue Badge guide, and part of our careful training is that we never have a group of more than 20, and they have got to be fully disciplined by the guide who's in charge.
And you have an umbrella or something to wave or something, do you?
Certainly not. That is most unprofessional.
So you keep yours under control, I can
yes,
imagine.
Yes, one has to use one's voice rather like a shepherd.
Now, college, we've mentioned women coming in the last century. How did the college change from those very early days through quite a few centuries?
The traditions, I'm glad to say, have remained the same. That purpose of the college, as you know, is education, learning, religion and research. And that remains the same and always has done throughout the centuries. This is the magnificent thing about Cambridge, is this wonderful continuity of effort and achievement towards that end.
And, of course, Stephen Hawking was here, I believe.
Yes, he became a fellow about 5 years after I did. I think at the time it was interesting because he was already being diagnosed with motor neurone disease, and it was clear that the college was going to have to support him very, very substantially. And I think, as a member of the college, I felt very proud that we were prepared to take on this responsibility for this young man.
Had quite a remarkable career, didn't he?
Indeed, yes, yeah. Indeed. As you know, his ashes are now in Westminster Abbey.
And you have a Stephen Hawking building, I believe, here?
No, we have a memorial plaque. It's actually a piece of stone in a pathway, which is just outside the room which he occupied in Keys Court.
And how large is Gomberland Keys?
Well, the total number is about 750. That's about 550 undergraduates and about just a little less than 200 postgraduates.
So that's sort of medium to large, isn't it?
No, we're actually the third largest of
really?
The colleges.
Really?
Yes, not many people realise that.
And is it just the one site, or have you got space elsewhere?
We have a new site over on West Road, where we actually have two substantial buildings. There's the Harvey Court, which dates from the 1960s, and then the Stephen Hawking building, which has only been open a few years.
Ah, that's probably the building I was thinking of, yes. And those are used for lectures or just for accommodation?
Those are essentially accommodation, although within the Stephen Hawking building we do have a very nice lecture centre called the Cavonius Centre, and that enables us to use that building for conferences, and the conferences can very well hold lectures and so on, and receptions over there.
What do you foresee of Cambridge and its colleges?
I would like to say I foresee continuity, that I hope our traditions will be substantially maintained, but that we shall continue, as always, to look to the future in research, philosophy, and the emerging ideas, and so on.
And how does a college like this work? Because you have all these fellows, and then you have a council, is that right?
Yes, we have 110 fellows, so that it's an unwieldy body, although we do meet together for major decisions. But the effective operation of the college is under the control of the college council, which is the master, the senior tutor, the bursar, and I think it's 9 fellows, so that they were able to carry out the executive decisions which are necessary to keep the college going.
And you, of course, are a life fellow. Are there many here?
Yes, indeed, there are. I believe at the last count there was something like 30.
And are you one of the older ones? Or?
I'm actually number 4 in the pecking order.
I wondered if there might be something like that. So how old is the oldest?
The oldest, I think, is 91 or 92, our senior fellow, yes.
Right, and you're obviously all very sprightly gentlemen.
We like to think so.
Dr. Michael Wood, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much for inviting me.